Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan. Engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and I'd like to welcome you to today's show titled Finding Life's Purpose. Now, please note that all the chat board questions and answers will be posted on the chat board and my webpage within a day or so of the show. And we welcome your questions, so please feel free to write them in. Our goal of pursuing and learning about spirituality is all about helping us mature and evolve. A key part of this process is to better understand ourselves and our life's purpose so that we can make the best use of our lives. Our guest today is Dr. Ron Alexander, author of Wise Mind, Open Mind, Finding Purpose and Meaning in Times of Crisis, Loss, and Change. Dr. Alexander is a licensed psychotherapist and the executive director of Open Mind Training Institute in Santa Monica, California, a leading org-edge organization that offers personal and professional training programs in mindfulness-based mind-body therapies, transformational leadership, and meditation. His unique method combines teaching from ancient wisdom and positive psychology and creative thinking into an integrated mind-body program. Dr. Alexander has been a leading pioneer in the fields of mindfulness, gestalt therapy, somatic psychotherapy, Ericksonian mind-body therapies, holistic psychology, and integrative and behavioral medicine since 1970. Dr. Alexander conducts professional and personal training programs throughout the U.S., Canada, Europe, Australia, and Asia. Dr. Ron Alexander, welcome to the show, Ron. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, you much of your philosophy in your book, which I read and enjoyed, is derived from Buddhism. How'd you get involved in all of this, Eastern religions?
Well, I had a fascinating trajectory where I was a nice Irish Catholic Boy Scout from Boston, and we would go to Catholic church on Sundays, and I started reading about Thomas Merton because I was very interested in the Christian mystics, St. Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross, Thomas Merton. And so then I started to attend a Benedictine monastery out in Western Massachusetts and go on retreats there. And then I decided to transfer from the university in Boston to University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and they had this wonderful five-college program where you could take classes both at the University of Massachusetts and at any of the other four colleges in the Valley. And so one of them was Smith College, and they had a wonderful program, probably one of the best in the country in Buddhist studies. So I started taking classes there, majoring in psychology at UMass Amherst and then minoring in Buddhist studies at Smith. And then there was another college called Hampshire College, which was really for people who were really creative, self-disciplined, wanted to work on film, music, in art. And they had a variety of courses also on Buddhism and Buddhist studies. And so one of the classes that I took was with a woman who was in her mid-70s, the late Teresina Havens. And she was a Quaker Buddhist scholar, and she had taught at Yale University for many, many years and had spent a lot of time with her husband, who was a religious psychologist, the late Joseph Havens. And so I started at a very young age, around age 20, spending a lot of time hanging out at their house. And interestingly enough, the way that she would mentor or teach me about Buddhism is we would go and arrange to have a mentoring session. I would arrive at her farmhouse out on Main Street in Amherst, overlooking the beautiful Connecticut Valley, and I would be expecting like tea in the kitchen and then 1 to 2 hours of her teaching me. And we would take our tea and go out into the garden, and we would work weeding and planting and fertilizing. And she would talk about the nature of life, the meaning of life, the importance of being a gardener to both plants in the garden, but also to people. And so I got a very kind of hands-on experience of what real Buddhism is about, you know, learning about the truth, learning about the way, that it's a philosophy, a way that you live your life. I learned that mindfulness wasn't just, or Zen practice wasn't just a practice that you did on your cushion, but you also, you did it when you were working in the garden, or you were working on a term paper, or you were driving around to pick up groceries.
Sounds like she's a fairly clever woman, or was. She was able to get some inexpensive help from the students and teach them at the same time.
Yes, she was very clever. And she was extremely interesting because we had one class, and it was called Buddhism, Death and Dying. And on Halloween, she said, we won't meet from 10 to 12 on Wednesday morning. We'll meet at 11:30 in the cemetery in downtown Amherst.
11:30 at night you're talking about?
Yeah. And so okay. We had a class outside where we sat and meditated, and we meditated, of course, on the purpose of living a full life. And then we were to pick a tombstone and sit by someone, and then we were to imagine our life as a 20-year-old, and then as a 40-year-old, 60-year-old, and an 80-year-old, and to visualize the complete progression of that, so that there was that sense of applying Zen, applying mindfulness to the beginning, the middle, and the end of one's life. And then she even had us, I think we were looking for Emily Dickinson's grave in one of the nights, because Emily Dickinson used to live in Amherst, and we were to sit by the grave and meditate.
No, that's interesting. Is that where she was? Is that where she died out there?
I don't know. I just remember Teresina saying, "See if you can find Emily Dickinson's grave."
All right. Now your focus is more on Zen Buddhism than on standard Buddhism. Is that correct?
Well, it was in the beginning, Dave. But I would say I've had a expansive trajectory in that in my early years, I studied Zen and was ordained in the lay Zen tradition. But from Zen, I became very interested in a method of Buddhism called from the Theravadin school, which is Southeast Asia, and had the opportunity to study in Sri Lanka. And then I worked as a student with two gentlemen, Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein, and they were from the Barry Center, the Insight Meditation Society, which was about an hour from Amherst. And then when I moved out to California, I spent a lot of time taking their retreats over about a 10-year period. And their branch of Buddhism is called Vipassana, or Insight Meditation. And Insight comes from the a Pali word, sati. So, you know, satipatthana means insight or gaining wisdom into the nature of mind, gaining wisdom into the true nature of what is the self and what is the no self. And then after that, I spent time in India and in Nepal and in Thailand, and I've had the unique blessing to work with the advanced Tibetan school of Buddhism called Dzogchen and Mahamudra. And in my last 5 years, so I worked with a Tibetan Lama named Sokni Rinpoche, and his father was the great Tibetan Lama called Tukul Urgen Rinpoche. And he left his body about 10 years ago. And he has several sons. One's Mingyur Rinpoche, who lives up in the Bay Area, and then Sokni Rinpoche lives out in Creston, Colorado now. So I've worked with Sokni very extensively. And then more recently, I had the opportunity to work with Daniel Brown, who's been affiliated with the Harvard Medical School for about 40 years. And I actually met Teresina Havens through Daniel Brown. And he was studying with her when I arrived in Amherst, and he was headed off to the University of Chicago to study divinity and psychology and Sanskrit and Tibetan Buddhism. And so last year or so, I've been studying with him again because he teaches in a lineage of the Dzogchen and the Mahamudra lineages. And he's also a longtime friend.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Friend.
One of the things that the title of your book says is finding purpose in life. Now, you know, some people seem to live a happy-go-lucky life and everything kind of seems to fall in line, and you know, other people don't. As far as finding a purpose, is it important to have a purpose in life?
I think it is. At a very young age, I had mentioned earlier that I became a Boy Scout. And one of the things that you discover when you're pursuing the path of being a Boy Scout is there's many, many different classes. There's Tenderfoot, Second Class, First Class, Star, Life, and then the Eagle Scout badge.
Right.
And you actually have to get 21 merit badges and go through a very extensive, it's almost like a doctoral defense review with a committee of these wise older men to be examined. And so at a very young life, young age, I started to question, well, what is the meaning of life? I loved the ocean. I grew up in the Boston, Cape Cod area, and I would sit and walk by the ocean for hours and hours, even before I was a meditator, and wonder, in the day, look at the ocean and the sun, and at night, go out and look at the stars and wonder, well, why are we here? What is the reason? Do we have a purpose of being here? Is this a simple biological walkthrough, like Darwin says? Or is there more of a mystical and spiritual purpose that we have here, that perhaps this is, perhaps, because we can't know unless we truly experience whether there are past lives or not, but, you know, what if this is just one of many incarnations, and what are we here to do with purpose? And I like to use the two P's, purpose and passion. And I discovered at a very young age, because I became very passionate about the exploration of my own spirituality and got very deeply involved in meditation and the studying of 4, 5, 6 different systems of yoga and many, many trips to India, got very involved with, well, what is my purpose, and how can I bring meaning into my life, and how can I bring meaning and purpose into other people's lives? And that thus became my interest in becoming a psychologist, psychotherapist, was that by helping people, and by what we call in the yogic system, by practicing some form of active seva, and the word seva means service, and giving back to the world and mentoring other people in the same way that I was mentored by Teresina and Joseph Havens and several other very helpful and spiritually wise people. So I think that we do have a purpose. I think for some of us it will fall into our lap. For me, it was very auspicious. Amherst my time there seemed to bring many, many various paradigms of self-growth. I came upon the book, The Self in Transformation by Herbert Fingeret. And it's a book about both psychoanalysis and mysticism. And it was one of the first books, along with the Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda. And one afternoon, I was walking down, after I went to the Yellow Sun Food Co-op in Amherst, I passed the bookstore, and there was this book with a huge poster in it, and it said, Be Here Now. And again, I was 20 years old, and I went, Be Here Now, wow. And then it sort of just grabbed me. And Baba Ramdas was the author of it, and he was coming, you know, because we had the speaker, Distinguished Speakers Program in Amherst, where every month we brought in someone who was very spiritually evolved, was a philosopher, and we invited Ramdas and Gene Houston and Alan Watts. We even invited Ken Kesey once, which that's a whole other story. He was a very funny guy with what he did with the speaker series, and Choyum Trungpa Rinpoche, the Tibetan Lama, the author of The Myth of Freedom and Meditation in Action. And so I was really deeply grabbed, I think, by the universe. And simultaneously, I was also reading existential philosophy and existential psychology, and Sartre, and Camus, and Merleau-Ponty. And all of those writers and scholars said that you basically experience yourself in a thrown sense, that we are thrown into this world, or into this existence, or where we find ourselves thrown into this incarnation. And then the question is, well, what are you going to do about it? Sartre said that man, and when I say man, I mean man, woman, needs a project, that you need to grasp onto something, you know, find a train or a bus or a wagon or a horse and climb on it, jump up onto it, and grab that meaning and take passion and apply it to purpose. So that your life, that you're building your life in the same way that you would build your dream home. A lot of people put a lot of importance on finding a piece of land, or finding their dream home and remodeling it, or, you know, getting their dream car, or even their dream job. But I think what's most essential underneath all of those kinds of activities, which are wonderful activities, and I mean, I live in a dream house out in California. I call it, you know, my Zen compound. But what's more important, I think, is finding what is your core meaning? What are your core values? Why are you here? And what are you here to do? And, of course, in the world that we live in today, what are you here to offer and to give back to the world? And what are you here to receive? And to take from the world, and to create that wonderful sense of alchemical combustion between energy in from the world to the self, and then energy out from the self towards the world.
Okay, and and in your book, you give us some ideas on how you might go about doing that. And you talk a lot about meditation, and in particular, mindfulness meditation. Can you talk to us a little about that? How does that work, and how does that help us find our purpose?
Yes, mindfulness meditation is an outgrowth of the Theravadin Buddhist meditation, what is known as Vipassana, and it means insight. And insight takes us to a place of both self-wisdom and wisdom of other people. And so mindfulness, what I'd like about studying mindfulness and teaching mindfulness is that it teaches you not only to be mindful of your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, your sensations, tastes, smells, sounds, on the cushion, as we say, but more importantly, it teaches you to be mindful when you're not sitting on the meditation cushion, when you're working, when you're in a relationship, or you're managing people. As to how to manage and interact with people in a mindfully respectful way. How to deal with the issue of you're standing in line at the bank and you've got 7 minutes to get back to see a patient, and someone's in front of you and they're talking about their hairdresser to the bank teller, and you find yourself, you know, tapping your foot in a kind of Irish Bostonian way.
Right.
One part of you wants to just say out loud, will you just get on with it? And, you know, I've got to get back to work here. And then you drop into the mindful place, which is, well, the person in front is really having a very meaningful conversation. She really wants to tell the bank teller about the wonderful time she had at the hairdresser. And so mindfulness at its core means that it's important to be mindful all the time. And not just when you're practicing on your cushion. And in the last 10 years, we've really seen what I've come to coin the focus revolution. Mindfulness has been on the cover of Time magazine, Newsweek. I just contributed a chapter for a 2-volume textbook that Ellen Langer edited out of Harvard University. It's called a Wiley-Blackwell Handbook on Mindfulness and Psychotherapy. And when you think of that, like, wow, Harvard University has a program where they not only teach mindfulness, but there's research that's going on in the Harvard Medical School, the Mind-Brain-Body Institute with Sarah Lazar and several other researchers. And out here in California, we have at Stanford, there's a program on mindfulness and compassion. And at UCLA, we have the Mindfulness Awareness Research Center, where I teach occasionally. And then down at UC Irvine, they also have a program on mindfulness and empathy and self-compassion. And that mindfulness is really in a proliferating way. It's spreading through the culture in a wonderful kind of trickle-down sense, where we're teaching parents to be involved in mindful parenting. We're teaching 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th graders in school who 5 or 6 years ago, they would immediately be sent to receive Ritalin and go on medication for their attention deficit disorders. And now we're discovering that if you pair mindfulness with physical activity, you get a better outcome with decreasing depression, lowering anxiety, and increasing focus and concentration than you do with a control group where you give them medication but there's no mindfulness or no physical exercise.
Okay. So, yeah, that's certainly interesting. We're speaking with Dr. Ron Alexander. Now, in your book, you list 3 steps to creating mindfulness meditation: letting go, tuning in, and moving forward. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yes. The first step, letting go, is very, very important. And that is that you have to let go of the kinds and qualities of thought processes or core beliefs that interfere with you being expansive. And I call those, and they're called and referred to in the Buddhist literature as hindrances. And hindrances can be laziness, it can be lack of focus, it can be the thought process that one isn't good enough, or one has no self-value. Hindrances need to be, you have to learn to let go of them. And then step two is you need to tune in to receive from your creative unconscious. I happen to believe, as the late great master hypnotherapist Milton Erickson, who was a master hypnotherapist in Phoenix, Arizona, that I had the good fortune to meet when I was about 26 years old, and he said that it was essential that one tunes in and connects, that in everyone's unconscious mind, there's a variety of resources, and there's a variety of healing resources, and there are a variety of creativity resources, and there are a variety of spiritual resources. And that, most importantly, to connect to that creative resource that really allows you to tune in to your personal unconscious, which is filled with that whole host of creative and spiritual and psychological resources, and then that you can go through the personal unconscious and tap into what Carl Jung referred to as the universal or the collective unconscious, and that in that collective unconscious is a vast repository of resources that one can connect to and tap into, infinite number of possibilities. And then the third step in my book that I write about is, so you know, you identify your hindrances, you tune in, and then you have to move forward. You have to take action. And this is where the importance of finding meaning and purpose in your life is. Without action, without an action plan, life kind of becomes a river that perhaps is coming through your property, or it's coming through the middle area of California, but it may not be fertilizing. It may not be allowing the land of yourself, metaphorically, to grow. And so you have to really have a structured approach in place where you have an action plan or a series of action plans to how are you going to move forward? How are you going to move on with your life so that you can bring to life your vision? You can bring the passion that you feel inside. You can light the flame of it. And then you can bring alive the project, like writing a book or learning to play the guitar or writing poetry or living a creative life. That's another thing. Some people say that they don't feel creative and they don't feel that they could learn to play an instrument or write a book. And I oftentimes teach them when I'm working with them in my office that, well, how do you want to run your company in a creative way so that that gives you a feeling and an experience that you are a creative entrepreneur or you're a creative CEO or creative leader? So I think it's really important that you apply these three steps so that you have a structure in place to move your life and to move the development and the transformation of yourself forward, meeting the universe and greeting the cosmos.
So it's not so important on what you choose. It's, you know, you ought to choose something that interests you and then commit to it. Whatever that is.
Yeah, very well said, Dave, because I once asked someone when I was a young man, I said, well, do I just have one soulmate? Am I just going to find one woman in my life and live happily ever after? And this astrologer psychic in New England said to me, oh, no, you're capable of having 1,000 different soulmates. And then she turned to me and she said, in the same way, any of us are capable of having 1, 10, 25 different occupations or pathways that we could put and apply purpose and meaning into. So I don't think there's just one path for any one person. And sometimes I like to use the Hindu incarnational model and say that in each incarnation, we may find ourselves doing one thing, and then we come to a place where there's a beginning and a middle and an end of that. Like for me, there was university teaching for about 20 years. And around year 18, I found I was starting to get tired every time I drove to a different place, a different university to teach. I was getting tired. And so I started to listen to my unconscious, and my unconscious was saying, well, I think that has come to a peak, and now it's time to do something else. So that we are very capable of being at the helm of our own ship of self and sailing that ship of self towards the oceans and towards the land that we want to direct ourselves towards and arrive at. Now, from a spiritual perspective, and as a transpersonal psychologist, I also pay homage to that for myself. I think there was both a sense of feeling thrown in the world, but also being grabbed by the universe. And that it was pretty clear to me when I was in the Boy Scouts that, well, I was going to be a leader, and I was going to teach. And I didn't quite understand what I was going to teach or who I was going to lead, but I had a sense by being a 15, 16-year-old where I was leading other young boys in the Boy Scouts in a leadership role, that there was some sort of destiny, and that being in the Boy Scouts was kind of preparation.
Right. And it probably really didn't make much difference what you went into. You'd have ended up in some leadership role because that was, I guess, what you came here for, or one of the things you came here for anyway.
Yes, exactly. And I just happened to be grabbed by the universe, ending up in Amherst and having the synchronicity of meeting Buddhist teachers and right. psychologists that were Buddhist teachers that really kind of opened the door. I always call it similar to William Blake. I love the title of his book that I read when I was 21. You know, when the doors of perception are cleansed, everything becomes infinitely open.
And, yeah.
Yeah, the doors of perception.
Yeah. The meditation is really not easy for a lot of people. A lot of people kind of hesitate from it. But you came up and you had six steps to go through to improve your meditation results. Could you talk about some of those? You know, things like comfortable position and. You know.
Oh, yeah. I think it's really important, first to address, and Dave, what you said is really important because it really will probably help anyone who's listening. Meditation's just not easy. I'm 65. I've been meditating since I was 20. I taught myself how to meditate first when I was 20. And then I'm now studying at a very advanced level of Tibetan meditation. And I just came back from an 8-day retreat, and it was very, very difficult. And I was very surprised that someone with 45 years of meditation experience trying on some advanced approaches would have such difficulty, and yet it just comes with the territory. And so I think people, and especially the listeners, really need to know that meditation is very hard and difficult to do at first. But in my book, Wise Mind, Open Mind, I write about the term called mind strength. And that mind strength is very similar to if you've been out of shape or you're hurt your body in some way, or you perhaps broke your ankle or your arm and you can't exercise for a long time, and then you're told in physical therapy to go back to the gym. And what they teach you when you're rehabbing from an injury is that you start out with very, very small, light weights, short periods of exercise. And so in my book, I coined the term in Buddhism and in Western psychotherapy to apply mindfulness. I coined the term called mind strength. And that's very similar to working out in the gym, that you start to practice meditation in small amounts. And I recommend start out with like 3 minutes and then 5 minutes and build up to 20 minutes. And if you have time on the weekends, go to 45 minutes. And so in order to do that, it's important to know that it's going to be hard at first. But just like learning to ride a bike or skiing down a mountain or learning to swim, it gets easier as you progress. And so there are some essential postures, or what we call the pointing out forms that are involved that will help you learn to meditate in the most easiest way. And that's number one is to sit up in a chair or to sit on a meditation cushion, or if you have any kind of back pain, to sit up against the wall with a cushion or a pillow behind you. And then if anybody's listening who's infirmed and they're in a wheelchair or in a bed, is to just elevate your head in bed and hold a very solid and firm posture so that your spine is in alignment. And then the second pointing out exercises, everyone needs to have a mudra, like how do you hold your hands in meditation? And what we know from all of the wisdom traditions, whether it's Christian or Sufi or Islam or Buddhist or Hindu, is what when we meditate, we need to have a mudra. And a simple mudra for everyone who's listening is just to take your thumb and your first finger, lightly touch them together, and then place your palms in your lap or on the sides of your chair, facing up or facing down. Then the third point of concentration in meditation is you need a place to focus your eyes. And in this short interview, I'll just make it concise so that the takeaway is easy, and that's either you focus your eyes on the tip of your nostrils with your eyes closed, or you can focus your eyes at the space between your eyebrows called your third eye. And to start off, it's easiest when you're learning to meditate to close your eyes. However, some folks really like to have their eyes open about a third of the way, and there are some individuals that like to look out the window, or if they live by a lake or the stream or like the ocean, they like to look at the ocean. And that's perfectly fine. Inner and out of meditation eventually all become one anyways. And then the next object of concentration is take your tongue and gently have it rise up to the tip of your mouth and have it touch your palate. And then the next object of concentration, which is probably the most important of all of these various objects of concentration in creating a meditation practice, is you need something to focus on. And there's two schools. In the mindfulness Buddhist school, there's what's called the concentration approach. And so I'll just give everyone a very simple concentration method, and that's as you're breathing in, and you're slowly breathing in through your nose, and you're breathing into your abdomen and then up into your lungs and chest, you're repeating the word rising. And then you just hold the breath for like one, two, or three breaths. And then as you're breathing out and you're emptying the air out of your lungs and out of your abdomen, you're repeating the word falling away, so that the breath is rising on the in-breath and it's falling away on the out-breath. And that's essential because the mind's going to be immediately filled with thought and lots of hindrances and distractions and planning and organizing, and the mind goes into the past, it goes into the future. You start having all sorts of feelings, emotions, and what we do in the Buddha school is no matter where the mind goes, no matter where the emotions are, if you have pain in your body, you just keep coming back to rising on the in-breath, falling away on the out-breath, rising on the in-breath, falling away on the out-breath. Now, that's the concentration school of Buddhist meditation. It's also equally important to say, well, no one meditation approach fits all learners. And there's actually thousands of approaches. And there's another school, and it's not Buddhist, it's Hindu, and it's called the absorptional approach. And that's, for example, say something like transcendental meditation. In transcendental meditation, or in any of the Hindu yogic systems of meditation, you do everything that I said, but instead of saying in and out, you repeat a mantra. And so, for example, a simple mantra can be Ra on the in-breath, and the meaning of the word Ra, you know, means sun energy, vibrancy, aliveness. And it also, in the Hindu mythology, it represents the divinity of the god of Ram. You know, Ram is divinity. He is all of which is divine. And then Ma, which is the moon energy, it's the mother, it's the feminine. So you're really balancing the masculine and the feminine with the mantra Ra on the in-breath and Ma on the out-breath. And that will take you to a very, very deep place of absorption and oneness.
And then you say something that we ought to keep a mindfulness journal. What I got out of it was things are going to come to our mind as we meditate, and we should make note of those. But how do you do those in the middle of it? Do you remember them afterwards, or do you take a break and say, "Boy, that was clever. I'm going to write that down." Tell us about the mindfulness journal.
Okay, the mind. I'm glad you brought that up, Dave, because the mindfulness journal. After about 30 years of practicing in the traditional Asian way, where you're supposed to just sit and you're not supposed to do anything but sit, I developed a hybrid approach. And I found that when I was sitting, I oftentimes would have lots of creative thoughts as well as distracting thoughts, or I'd have very positive emotions as well as painful emotions or sensations in my body. And so I developed what I call the mindfulness journal, which is you can have a yellow pad of paper or a really beautiful journal that you've bought at the bookstore, or you could, for this day and time, have your iPad out or your iPhone and have notes open, and to start to type in the middle of your meditation, if you have inspiration that's arising, is to write it down. And it's also a great journal, in addition to writing down creative ideas and important feelings and sensations that are arising during the meditation, it's also very, very important to utilize it to track the process of your meditation, so that I oftentimes suggest that people write in the mindfulness journal what they're experiencing. What are they thinking about? What are they feeling? What are they sensing? What's their mood at the beginning of the meditation? And then to utilize it, as I said before, through the middle of the meditation, is to open their eyes and write for 1 or 2 minutes, then to go back into the meditation and bring the meditation to a completion, closure, at the end of 20 or 30 or 45 minutes, and then to write, what are they thinking, what are they feeling, do an assessment of what their mood is after they've meditated, what's the state in their body. For example, oftentimes I may start a meditation and I'm after a certain degree of pressure or stress, or there's some emotion or feeling that I'm working with that day, and then to notice and to be delighted, and oftentimes really surprised that after you've sat, even with a very powerful emotion, such as one of my clients just died of brain cancer, and I knew her and her husband very, very well over the last 20 years. And so grief and sadness has been an emotion that I've been working with in the last 3 weeks since she died. And I was very surprised that the other day, at the end of the meditation, there was joy and there was bliss and there was equanimity. And so that the meditation allowed me to sit for a while with the sad feeling and the feeling of grief and loss, but it very wonderfully transformed, in what we call in Buddhism, it transmuted the painful state into a more blissful, joyful state.
Yeah, that's so fantastic. Yeah. We're rapidly running out of time, but I have to ask you this one other thing because I liked it so much, and I need a relatively short answer, but your wisdom support council. I thought that was really clever. Could you tell the listeners a little bit about your concept of a wisdom support council?
Okay. Part of how I became successful was not just on my own, and it was seeking out, starting with the Havenses and Daniel Brown, and I could go through a whole host of people that have mentored me and been influential, not just as spiritual teachers or psychologists or supervisors, but throughout my life. And I, interestingly enough, learned this through the Boy Scouts, which is that because you have to get 21 merit badges, you go out and you study with 21 different people. And so I was thinking through when I was writing the book, well, how did I become so successful? And how did I arrive at this? And I thought, well, it was that I would always seek out mentors, advisors, teachers, clinicians, gurus. And I created in the book the Wisdom Council of Support. And what I suggest very briefly is that if you really want to be a winner, and you want to be on the winning side, regardless of whether it's enlightenment or just entrepreneurial success, is gather together a group of people in your life that you can metaphorically have like the president's cabinet, a wisdom council of support, people that you can go to that are not going to just make you feel good, but they're also going to be the people that challenge you. And the people that confront you, and the people that say, you know, that project doesn't sound like it has the kind of values that you would want to keep yourself in. Sure, it might be an interesting financial opportunity, but I wouldn't go with that. I would let that go. I would go with that publishing company. I would go with this one. So a Wisdom Council of Support is a group of people that advise you, they mentor you, they challenge you.
Yeah, that's a really good idea, and I think some people do it here and there, but making a conscious attempt to find those people. We all have them in our life. Yeah. We just need to use them maybe a little more wisely than sometimes we do.
Yeah, really listen to them.
Yeah, exactly. We have run out of time. We're talking to Dr. Ron Alexander. How can people find you and get in touch with you?
Oh, I'll just go to www.ronaldalexander.com and also www.openmindtraininginstitute.com.
Okay, great. Well, Ron, it was great to have you with us today. I really appreciate you being here. Best of luck.
It was a pleasure, David. Thanks so much.
Take care. Okay. Bye-bye. Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Note that I post the answers to all the chat board questions on my website at davidgagan.com. You can also ask additional questions on my website about this show or any other show, and I'll post those as well. I hope to hear from you in regards to your thoughts about today's show and ideas for future topics. Also, I cover these subjects and a lot more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. Also, all the shows are available on iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You're a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.